Hi, good morning. Can everybody hear me without the mic? Is it okay if I don't use it? Okay, thank you. I think that everyone can agree that food is a very important component in Judaism. It's the way we mark kind of all important occasions, and I think many of us form emotional memories around food at a Shabbat table, at a holiday meal, right? It takes a very positive place in our minds and in our hearts. And I think our memories are often defined by these sumptuous delicacies that are served. And again, we create memory around food. Now imagine this. A group of slaves just left Egypt. And they are wandering in a vast desert towards an unknown land. And as we will read in this coming week's Parashat B'Shalach, the following, source number one. Vayisu me'elim vayabohu kol adat b'nei Yisrael el midbar sin asher bein elim uvein sinai b'chamisha asar yom l'chodesh hasheni l'tzeitam me'aretz Mitzrayim. Okay, so b'nei Yisrael journeyed from Elim. And they came to Midbar Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departing of the land of Egypt. Vayilonu kol adat b'nei Yisrael al Moshe v'al ha'aron b'midbar v'yomru aleihem b'nei Yisrael. Mi ten mutenu b'yad Hashem b'eretz Mitzrayim. V'shivtenu al sir ha'basar b'achlenu lechem l'sova ki hotetam otanu el ha'midbar hazeh l'hamit et kol ha'kahal hazeh bara'av. The whole congregation of Israel, all of Bnei Israel, came and murmured against Moshe and against Aaron in the wilderness. And they said, would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, when we did eat bread to the full, for ye have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. The fear of every parent that they would not have food to provide for their young. They look into this vast wasteland and they come to their leadership and say, from where am I supposed to feed my children? We are hungry. It would have been better had we died in the land of Egypt by the hand of God, when we sat by the flesh pots of meat, when there was bread to be eaten. Now, of course, this is a complicated pasuk, which I'll get to in a moment. But it's fascinating to note that this grumbling came only 3 days after the historic splitting of the sea. When we see it, if you look in source number two, Vayar Yisrael et hayara gdola asher asa Hashem b'Mitzrayim, Vayiru amat Hashem, Vayaminu b'Hashem u'b'Moshe avdo. We know B'nai Yisrael had faith 3 days earlier. Their emunah, their faith is declared not only in God but in Moshe. And yet 3 days later, they're nervous about food, and what's the first thing they do? They're complaining. And what do they say? It would have been better had we died in the land of Egypt when we were surrounded by meat and bread than here. Now all the Mefarshim ask, and the Midrash as well, is it true? They had tons of meat and bread to eat in the land of Egypt? That's certainly not the vision we have when we think about B'nai Yisrael having been slaves. It's a very complicated pasuk, and I don't really want to get into it now, but I think there's a lot of parallels between the story of the man and that of Pesach. And perhaps there's an allusion here to the Jews saying, we would have rather died in Makat Bechorot as we ate meat and bread than died out here of starvation. The fear of dying of starvation is tremendous. And I talked about how in Judaism, food is so important. It's actually true throughout the life cycle, right? Before a man or woman is put to death by capital punishment in this country, what are they entitled to? Right, the last meal of food of whatever they want. What's that about? Right? That in our legal system we decided that a murderer is entitled to have a scrumptious meal before he or she enters wherever they're about to enter in the next world. Right? And yet that's a value, this idea that when man dies, he should be satisfied with food. So it's interesting that that's their perception. Better we had died earlier, but with food in our bellies, than now dying in the desert of hunger. Interesting pasuk. But what is God's response here? He's not going to let them simply die in the desert. If you look in Pasuk Dalet, again, source number one, Vayomar Hashem al Moshe, Hineni mamtir lachem lechem min hashamayim, Vayata ha'am velaktu dvar yom biyomo, Lama'an anasenu, Hayelech betorati imlo. God says to Moshe, here's how it's going to be. I will rain down from you bread from the sky. And the people shall go out and gather each day that day's portion, that I may test them, God says. I will test them to see whether they will follow my instructions or not. It's a very strange pasuk. The people complain of hunger. God says, I will satiate that hunger by providing them every day with man in order to test them. But what did God mean in order to test them with the man? I would have thought the man was a kindness provided by God. What kind of test was it? And what does it actually mean for God to give a test in the first place? I think perhaps of all the biblical tests which God gives, the most famous was the test which God gave Abraham in Breshit Perek Chaf Bet, Pasuk Aleph, if you look source number 3, Vayhi achar hadvarim ha'ela, v'alohim nisa et Abraham, v'yomar elav, Abraham v'yomar hineni. It was after some time, or these things, depending how you understand that phrase, that God tested Abraham, and he said to him, Abraham, and he said, Abraham responded, hineni, right, I'm ready to do your bidding, God, and God tells him, you have to take your beloved son, Kachna, et Bincha, et Echidcha, Asher Ahavta, et Yitzchak, and you have to offer him as a sacrifice on a mountain which I will show you. And it's very difficult when reading this pasuk, and the Midrash struggles with what does it mean for an omniscient God, an all-knowing God, to test somebody? After all, if God does have foreknowledge, if he is all-knowing, then he knows exactly how the test is going to come out. He knows exactly how the test taker will perform. And thus, what's the point of the entire test? So the Midrash asks this question, and if you look now in source number 4, I think this is a beautiful, beautiful Midrash that captures all the different possibilities for why God might test someone. So if you look now in source number 4, this is from Breshit Rabbah. Hashem tzadik yivchan v'rasha v'ohev chama sana nafsho. God trieth the righteous, but the wicked and the lover of violence his soul hates. Amar Rabbi Yonatan says, Hapishtani hazeh kishapishtano loke eino makish alav biyoter mipnei shehi pokaat. Ukepishtono yafa humakish alav biyoter lama shehi mishtabachat veholechet. Opinion number 1 starts with a mashal, says Rav Yonatan. Here's what happens. A flax maker, when he wants to test his flax, if the flax is solid and good, the more he beats it, the better it will get. It will improve. Whereas if the flax is weak and broken, what will happen when the flax maker beats it? It will fall apart. Kach HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Eino menase tarasha'im lama she'in yochel ma'amo dechtiv ha'rasham kayam nigras v'et mi menase et tzadikim she'ne'amar Hashem tzadik yivchan. Thus is God. He's not going to test the wicked because they will surely, like the weak flax, falter and break. Who does God try? Only the righteous. Hashem tzadik yivchan. That's a pasuk from Tehillim. God tries the righteous. Mashal number 1. Mashal number 2. Vayhi achar dvarim ha'ela v'tisa eshet Adonav v'gomer. Vayhi achar dvarim ha'ela. This is a comparison between the test Yosef undergoes in the house of Potiphar with eshet Potiphar and our story with Avram. Amar Rabbi Yonatan. Hayotzar hazeh kishahu bodek et ha'kivshan shelo eino bodek et ha'kelim ha'mero'aim. Lama? She'eino maspik la'hakish alav achat ad shehu shovro. Umahu bodek, v'kankanim berurim, sha'afilu hu makish alav kama pe'amim, eino shovra. Shovro. Second mashal. He compares a potter. He looks at a potter. A potter who has a weak vessel and strikes it, what will happen? He gives a blow to a weak piece of pottery. Immediately it will crack. But what happens if you take a strong piece of pottery and hit it? It remains perfectly intact.
Kach HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ein kach ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu menase et harasha'im, ela et ha-tzadikim she-ne'amar Hashem tzadik yivchan.
So too with God. He only tests the righteous who are compared here to the strong piece of pottery, but he doesn't test the wicked because they will surely crack.
Finally, Amar Rabbi Elazar, L'ba'a bayit shayelo shtei parot, achat kocha yafe, v'achat kocha ra, al mihu notein et ha'ol, lo aloto shekocha yafe, kach ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu menase ela ha-tzadikim she-ne'amar Hashem tzadik yivchan.
The third example is when a man possesses two cows, one strong and the other feeble. Upon which cow does he place the yoke? Only the strong cow, because he does not want to put it on the weak one, surely upon the strong one. Similarly, God tests only the righteous, as it says, Hashem Tzadik Yivchan. I think we have in this particular midrash three different reasons why God tests individuals or communities, based on these three different mishalim. The first, the flax worker who beats his flax, he only does it to do what? To improve the already strong. Why does God test a person? Because it's good for him. Because it actually strengthens his character. And that is why God tested Abraham, in order to strengthen Abraham's whole character. Number two, God only tries the righteous, like the man, the potter, who only strikes the vessels that are already strong. Why? To show this is a strong piece of pottery. Why does God test Abraham? To show all of us this is a strong human being. You know, I always marveled about Abraham. We make such a big deal in Parshat Lech Lecha when God says to him, go forth to an unknown land. Wow, what a man of faith. He listened to God without question and just went. But we always forget how those psukim continue. God didn't just say, oh, go forth, I'll show you what to do. God said, and if you go forth, I will make you the father of a great nation. And later in that parak, God tells him, and you're going to inherit this whole land. Now, if you think about Abraham's situation previous to this, we don't know that much about him. We do know, however, that he had no children, and God's promising him a huge nation, and he had actually already left his birthplace. He had left Ur Kasdim and was now living in Haran. So God is actually telling him, leave this kind of temporary transitional place and go forth where I tell you, and I'll give you a huge nation and a nice chunk of land. I don't know about you, but I feel like Avram had nothing to lose. I would have gone. If I was in Avram's case, I would have gone. But then you get to Parakhof Bet, to the trial of Akedat Yitzchak. And there I know, if God said to me, bring your beloved son and sacrifice him, what my response would be, and it wouldn't have been the same as the original Lech Lecha. Right? Why did God test Avraham? To show us. You all question, you think God's random? You think Avraham was just, God was bored one day, so we found this random guy on the street and said, hey, you could be the father of a great nation. No. God's choice is vindicated by Avraham's behavior in Perek Chaf Bet. The fact that Avraham willingly took his son to be sacrificed. God tries only the righteous. He is that strong piece of pottery, and we all better know it. The third mashal, that of the man who owns two cows. Very interesting mashal. He's a strong cow and a weak cow, and he has to put the burden in order to plow on one of them. He's obviously going to choose the strong cow. Something about God's testing must, I think, from this mashal imply that by God testing a person, it actually improves the rest of the world. The cow plows the field. The cow improves the soil because he can bear the burden. Abraham could bear the burden and teach and show the rest of the world the light. That was the burden which God gave him. The burden of faith, the burden of carrying the message of God, and thereby improving the whole world. These are the three opinions in this midrash of why God, again, why God tests. For one, just to review, it improves the test taker. Two, it proves something of the strength of the test taker to the rest of the world. And somehow it actually improves the rest of the world by God testing an individual. That's interesting because for 2,000 years, Abraham was heralded as the champion of faith, renowned for his loyalty, for his obedience to God. During the Enlightenment, however, the entire Bible, and specifically the story of the binding of Isaac, was subjected to the ethical critique of the modern standards. And the most famous philosopher who really ripped apart the Akedah was Immanuel Kant. But there was one philosopher who came to the defense of Abraham, who coined the term Abraham was the knight of faith, and that was the 18th century Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard. In his very famous work, Fear and Trembling, Kierkegaard attempts a fascinating explanation of the test of Abraham. And he argues, based on Parakluf Bet Pasuk Aleph, that God was testing Abraham's faith in God. Why? Would Abraham continue to be a man of faith to believe in the virtue of the absurd, in Kierkegaard's words? What does that mean? Could Abraham hold in tandem two mutually exclusive realities? One parak earlier, in Parakluf Aleph, after Yitzchak was born and Ishmael had to be thrown out of the house, God said to Abraham, "Ki bi Yitzchak yikarei lechazer." Through Isaac you shall have descendants, you shall have progeny and children. And only a couple of psukim later, God says to him, "Take your beloved son Yitzchak and sacrifice him." Abraham believed by virtue of the absurd, whereby the impossible will happen and all human calculation is abandoned. Somehow these two things are both going to be true. And how is that possible? Kierkegaard says, only through faith. Only through faith can be Yitzchak yikarei lechazera, and kachnet bincha techidcha asher ahavta et Yitzchak, and sacrifice him, be held together. Those are two absurd statements, and believing in the possibility of both of those realities makes no sense to the finite human mind, except if you are a person of faith. But what kind of faith was it that God was testing of Abraham? I'd like you to please keep this in the back of your mind. I want to take this midrash for a moment and quickly apply it to the situation of Bnei Israel in the Midbar. We could argue, perhaps the man, God was using the man to somehow improve Bnei Israel's character. Or perhaps it was to prove the strength of Bnei Israel as the Am HaNivchar, as the Am Skula to the rest of the world. Or perhaps it was to improve the rest of the world by showing what Bnei Israel were capable of. Hold these three possibilities in your head as well. What I would like to do now, however, is look at some of the classical commentaries who answer the question of how the man was testing Bnei Israel. So if you look in source number 5, Rashi on the Pasuk, we are looking at Pasuk Tetzayin Dalet in Shemot. Laman anasenu heilich b'torati. Rashi says, Im yishmeru mitzvot hatuliyot bo, shelo yotiru mimenu velo yitzu b'shabbat lilkot. Whether or not they will observe the commandments associated with it, that they should not leave any overnight, they should not go out on the Sabbath to collect it. Rashi says the man was a test case for Bnei Israel. Why? And how was it a test? It was a test case. Why? Because there were many complex, different halachot associated with the man. And God was seeing, could Bnei Israel handle all the various details and laws connected? It would test their dedication to God. This is what halacha is going to look like. It's going to be multifaceted and complex. Will Bnei Israel go out and collect it on Shabbat? That's one aspect. Would they not leave any overnight? Rashi bases himself on the rest of the pasuk, right? I'm testing them to see if they'll follow my Torah. How are Bnei Israel going to react? Are they going to be dedicated when there's numerous laws associated with a particular mitzvah? That's Rashi. Ramban totally disagrees with Rashi, as he does quite commonly throughout Tanakh. And we're going to skip to, right? He starts by quoting Rashi, and he gets his own opinion in source number 6. Ve'inenu nachon. He says Rashi's not correct. Avalhu kemosha amar. It's rather like it says. And here, actually, Ramban quotes a pasuk from Sefer Dvarim, the other major place where it discusses the man, and we'll get to that in a moment, where it says, "Hama'alicha man bamidbar asher lo yadun avotecha lema'an anotcha ulema'an nasotecha lehitivcha ba'achritecha." Kinisayon hulahem shaloya biyadam mazon veloyer ulahem itabamidbar rakaman shaloyadu mitchila velo shamu me'avotam. V'yored lahem davar yom b'yomo v'yarivu alav v'im kol zeh shamu lalechad acharei Hashem lo makom lechem. Rather, says Ramban, the intent of the trial mentioned here is, as it says there in Dvarim, who fed thee in the wilderness with man which your fathers knew not, that he might afflict thee and that he might try thee and to do thee good in the end. The man itself, according to Ramban, was a trial. Why? They had no food in the desert, no recourse to any type of sustenance except the man, which they had never seen before, which they had no tradition of, which their fathers did not know. And each day's quantity came down on its day, and they were eagerly desirous of it. And God wanted to see, when they have no choice, no alternative, it's severely rationed, it's new, it's strange, would they anyway follow God into a desert without food? That was the test. Sforno in source number 7 says something else entirely as well. He says again, source number 7, Laman anasenu ha'elech b'torati, kishayyem mit parnei shalo b'tzar. Ke'amram zechornam lebracha lo nitna Torah lidrosh ela lo'ochlei haman. When they will have no food without toil, as our sages say, the power of interpretation of Torah was granted only to those who eat the man. According to Sforno, what was the man testing? It was a moral challenge. When Bnei Yisrael had a surplus of leisure time because their physical needs were completely met, what would they do with this leisure time, this time of relaxation? Would they spend it in spiritual pursuit instead? That was a test. God wanted to see. It's almost going back to Gan Eden. What will man do when all of his needs are provided for him? Will he take advantage of this situation? That's the test according to Sforno. Source number 8, Rashbam. Rashbam says, Mitoch shebechul yom v'yom einehem tluyot l'menuzotehen el mitoch kach yaminu bi ve'yelchu b'torati kemo shemeforash b'parshat v'haya ekev v'ya'ancha v'yaribecha. Rashbam says, because every day Bnei Yisrael would have to depend on God for their sustenance. Every single day. We'll get back to what that means in a moment. Ibn Ezra in source number 9 says something similar. Sheyitzarech elai b'chol yom. That they should be in need of me every day. According to the Ramban on some level, and very, very explicitly in Rashbam and Ibn Ezra, the trial of the man, the test which God was giving to Bnei Israel in the desert by giving them man, was a test of their outright dependence on God. And I would like to explore for a few minutes exactly what that means. But to do that, we have to look in Parshat Ekev, which many of the Mefarshim have just quoted, to look at the other place in the Torah where the whole story of the man is recalled by Moshe as he gives his Bnei Yisrael his final farewell, his final words before he leaves them. And he recalls many of the stories and the trials in the desert. So if you look now at sources 10 and 11 on your source sheets, he has the psukim from Dvarim. V'zacharta, says Moshe, et kol ha-derech asher holichacha Hashem elokecha ze arba'im shana b'midbar lema'an anotcha l'nasotcha ladat et asher b'lovecha hatishmor mitzvotav imlo.
ויענך ויריבך ויאכילך את המן אשר לא ידעת ולא ידון אבותיך למען הודיעך כי לא על הלחם לבדו יחיה האדם כי על כל מוצא פי השם יחיה האדם. You shall remember, says Moshe, all the way which the Lord thy God had led thee these past 40 years in the wilderness, that he might afflict you to prove to know what was in your heart, whether or not you would keep his commandments. And he afflicted you, and you had to suffer hunger. And he fed you with man which you knew not, nor did your fathers know, so that you might understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man may live on anything which God decrees. If you look a little later in the parak, this is source number 11. Hamachilcha man bamidbar asher lo yadun avotecha lema'an anotcha ulema'an nasotecha lehitivcha ba'achritecha. Who fed you in the wilderness with man which your fathers knew not, that he might afflict you and he might test you, and it'll be better for you in the end. Once again, the language of testing, very powerful psukim. And I just want to go on a very brief but important tangent. From these psukim which we just read, the rabbis derive a major, difficult halachic prohibition. And that is, we've been talking about food, that in the day of Yom Kippur, we are not permitted to eat. Now it's interesting because if you look at the psukim in which God commands us to sanctify Yom HaKippurim, it never ever says explicitly that what we cannot do on Yom Kippur is that we cannot eat or drink. The Torah simply says, if you look in source number 12, Vayikra, Chav Gimel Chav Zayin, Ach ba'esor l'chodesh ha-shvi'i hazeh, Yom HaKippurim hu mikra kodesh yelachem, v'initem et nafshotechem, v'ikravtem ish el Hashem. Mark the 10th day of the 7th month is the Day of Atonement. There shall be a holy convocation for you, and you shall afflict your souls, v'initem et nafshotechem, and you shall bring an offering made by fire unto the Lord. So the pasuk is explicit. There has to be some kind of affliction done on Yom Kippur, but the Torah never actually says what that affliction is going to be, what it will look like. And so the rabbis and the Gemara debate what this affliction should be. So if you look in source 13, we're going to skip around a little in the Gemara, but if you look now, source 13, Tanu Rabbanan, Ta'anu et nafshotechem. This is actually from another set of psukim which describe Yom Kippur, where it says, Ta'anu et nafshotechem, you have to afflict your souls. Yachol yashav b'chamo b'tzana k'day sheyitzta'er Talmud lomar v'chol melacha lo tasu ma melacha shaval tase af inoy nefesh shaval tase. The rabbis taught, you shall afflict yourselves. So shall we then assume that one has to go out into the sunshine or in the cold and afflict suffering upon himself? If Yom Kippur is late in the year and it's very cold, should I then go stand outside in a t-shirt? I'm afflicting myself. Or if it's earlier in the year and you're in Israel and it's boiling hot, should I go out and stand in the sun? Yes, that would be an affliction. However, if you look in the pasuk in Vayikra Tet Zayin where it says, "Be ta'anu et nafshotechem," the next phrase says, "V'kom lacha lo ta'asu," you shall not do any work. Because that is formulated in the negative, you shall not do any work. So according to the Gemara, the affliction itself must be negative. I.e., what does that mean? Some form of abstinence. You do not have to actively go and afflict yourself, but actually you have to deprive yourself of something. It's some kind of deprivation or abstinence. That's what the affliction needs to be. Self-denial. And if you skip a couple lines down to the end, Rabbi Yishmael Tana ne'amar kan inoy, v'ne'amar lahalan inoy, mala halan inoy ra'avon, af kan inoy ra'avon. So, we solve our problem, right? We know that we have to do some form of affliction that is a deprivation, depriving ourselves of something. But what should that look like? So when the rabbis of the Gemara don't know, they try to find the connection. We have the word inoy, afflict yourself by Yom HaKippurim. And where else do we have the term inoy?
in Parshat Ekev by the man. Right, it said it is an affliction. Right, he afflicted you. And if you look back in Varim Pasuk Gimel, v'ya'ancha v'yarivecha, he afflicted you by subjecting you to hunger. If by the man the affliction was hunger, the fact that Enoi was hunger, then what must the Enoi be by Yom HaKippurim? What's the affliction, the deprivation which we must have on Yom Kippur? Hunger. Right, make the connection between these two psukim. When Moshe described the giving of the man, he said, again, God subjected you to an Enoi of hunger, so too here by Yom HaKippurim, it is hunger. The Gemara continues a little bit later on. Right, it quotes the psukim from Dvarim Parakhet, Amalchicha man bamidbar lema'an anotecha. Right, so God fed you man in the wilderness, which your fathers never knew, in order to afflict you, to test you, which will benefit you in the end. Does anybody see the distinction between, if you look in Dvarim Perek Chet, Pasuk Gimel, it says, Vaya'ancha v'yarivecha, God afflicted you to hunger and gave you the man. Now look again in Pasuk Tet Zayin, it says, Laman onotcha ulaman nasotcha lehitivcha ba'acharecha. God gave you the man, which was itself an affliction. So interesting. Dvarim seems to be saying two things. Bnei Israel went through two stages of affliction. The first Enoi was the fact that they experienced hunger. Right? The first Enoi was that they were hungry, they were starving. They turned to Moshe and said, "We don't have food." The second Enoi, according to Dvarim Chet Pasuk Tet Zayin, the second Enoi was the man itself. The Pasuk seems to be saying that the man itself was some kind of Enoi, was some kind of affliction. Not just the hunger pangs which Bnei Israel felt, which is how we get the halacha in Yom Kippur that we cannot eat meat, that we cannot eat, sorry, food at all. But the man itself is some kind of affliction. Why? How? What was the affliction or the hardship of the man itself? So if you look down, Eino Dome, source 13, the very last line, Eino Dome Misha Yesh Lo Pat Besalo, Lemisha Ein Lo Pat Besalo. One cannot compare someone who has bread in his basket to one who does not have bread in his basket. What does that mean? When Moshe recalls the giving of the man, he says, remember the derech. Remember the 40-year journey which you were on, that God led you to test you, to afflict you, to know what was in your heart. And this is followed by the giving of the man, which is also called an enoi, an affliction and a test. What is the test? What is the affliction of the man? So again, according to the Ramban, it's the fact that Bnei Israel are facing something new, something strange, something they can't ask their parents about. They have to come to an understanding of the man on their own. You are being pulled out of your comfort zone, says the Ramban. You're forced to explore something new. But according to the Gemara, what does it mean? You cannot compare someone who has bread in his basket to someone who does not. Something I think we often miss when we think about the man is the fact that when you went out and got your food, you could not save it for the next day. Every single night, Bnei Israel, mothers and fathers, went to sleep with no food in their cupboards. No guarantee that the next day they'd be able to feed their children. Excuse me. Every day, going to sleep, having to trust that God would provide for them the next day, that food would fall from the heavens and fill their bellies. The Enoi, the affliction of the man, was an Enoi of faith. But not the same faith which they were tested and had and proved to have after Kriyat Yamsuf,
when it says Vayaminu b'Hashem uv'Moshe Abdo. They had faith in Moshe and God. But this was something different. This was a different kind of faith. It was the torture, the affliction of having to rely on God, on having to trust, something that a group of slaves certainly did not have. It's interesting because philosophers and theologians have observed that the word faith covers numerous types of categories of religious existence. And the great Jewish philosopher, Martin Buber, describes two types of faith in his work by the same name, which then Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb further sharpens in his book, Faith and Doubt. The first category of faith is called cognitive faith. Cognitive faith, it's acknowledgement. It is intellectual. It is the belief that I intellectually accept that certain propositions or information is true. I believe that God exists. I believe that God is one. I believe that God created the world. It is completely an intellectual faith that occurs cognitively. It occurs in the mind. And that corresponds to the Hebrew word emunah. Vayaminu b'Moshe, b'Hashem u'b'Moshe avdo. Cognitive faith, emunah. The second category is affective faith. It's not the belief that, but rather the belief in. It refers to trust. It's personal, it's emotional. It's felt not only in the head, but in the heart. It bespeaks a sense of trust, reliance, dependence, hope. It's the desire for relationship. And it corresponds to the Hebrew word not emunah, but bitachon, to have trust. Two types of faith, cognitive, intellectual acknowledgement, and affective, emotional trust. The Jews had emunah. They saw the plagues. They experienced the Exodus. They walked through the Red Sea. At Mount Sinai, the Jews actually heard God Himself speak to them. They saw His miracles, His greatness, His power. And God demonstrated, as He related in the first commandment, I'm Hashem your God, believe in me. And they did. They believed in Him. But the man was different. The man was different. The man was a 40-year exercise in faith building. So Moshe says to the people, remember the derech, remember the way. Each and every member of Bnei Yisrael had to experience and endure uncertainty and learn how to have a relationship with God that was based in trust, to have effective faith, trust that God would provide for them and their children. It always struck me, excuse me, I'm going to use a mic. Oh, no, I'm okay. Okay, it always struck me that in Parshat Akev, when Moshe is recalling and retelling the narratives of Bnei Yisrael after their exodus from Egypt, that the story of the man is told almost back to back with the story of Chedah Egel, the story of the sin of the golden calf. Now, if you look back in Shemot, there are many stories that happen in between. Right, the story of the man is told in Perek Tet Zayin, and the pasu and the Perek of Chedah Egel is until Lamed Bet, and we have numerous stories in between. And yet, in Parshat Akev, when Moshe is recalling these accounts, he tells them both back to back. And my question was: is there a connection somehow between these two stories? Why are these two stories, the story of the man and of the golden calf, related so closely? Now, we assume that the story of Chedah Egel was a reflection of the failure of the Jewish experience at Mount Sinai. Is that somehow, in any way, connected to the man as well? Because we as biblical readers, we're reading along in Sefer Shemot, and we almost can't believe Chet HaEgel. 40 days after God said to the people, "I'm Hashem, your God," what do? They build an idol at the foot of Mount Sinai. How is it fathomable? It's funny because my students always say to me, "If I could just see God, then I would really believe. If God would just come to me and tell me, believe in him, I could do it. Why are there no open miracles anymore?" And yet Chet HaEgel is a perfect example of they saw God. They saw open miracles. And 40 days later, they're building a calf at the foot of Mount Sinai. Why? Did they forget what they heard? Did they forget what they heard 40 days earlier? No, they hadn't forgotten. But they did not trust. Moshe was gone. They hadn't heard a peep from God in 40 days or 40 nights. And the lesson of the man, the lesson of faith, of trust, had yet to be learned. Cognitive enlightenment can come in a flash. It is possible to be utterly moved by the grandeur of an experience like Mount Sinai to change one's mind, to believe something new, to believe that God exists. Sure, they believed that. But to change one's nature, to change one's heart and one's soul, that takes time. To form a relationship, that takes time. And any inconvenience, any hardship, any bump along the road will cause a relationship of trust to suffer. Lack of water, lack of meat, Moshe's gone for too long, the land seems unconquerable. The complaints of Bnei Israel were always so disturbing. Why, time and time again, in Sefer Shemot and Sefer Bamidbar, why do they keep doubting? They've seen God. Isn't that enough? But in the first year of building a relationship, it's not enough. And if we remember, all of these trials happened at the beginning. They happened in that first year or so. To construct a faith that is not only cognitive, belief that, but a faith that is effective, a belief in, that takes 40 years to accomplish. Day in and day out, they had to trust God. They had to go to sleep with no food, no guarantee that they'd be able to provide sustenance for their families. They had to learn what it meant to trust, to believe in. Okay? To believe in. That is the test. To trust God. An affliction, an inoy, says the Gemara, is a deprivation. To be deprived of one's certainty. Is there a greater affliction? And yet to be certain. That is the definition of faith. It is the absurdity of faith. And I believe that was the test of Abraham. Abraham, who was told to sacrifice the son through whom he would have progeny and descendants. How do you believe a God who says such a thing? Because you trust him. To not know and yet to know. Or to be uncertain and yet to trust. That was the affliction of the man. A test of faith. But after 40 years of trust building, it was over. Just when the people might have lapsed into a feeling of complacency, where they came to expect it. It was no big deal. We'll have food from heaven every day. That's our lot in life. At that moment, everything would change. They would enter the land of Israel and the man would stop. And it actually tells us that from the beginning. If you look back in Shemot Tet Zion, we find out from the very beginning that when they enter Eretz Israel, this would stop. If you look at Source 14, Uvnei Israel achlu et haman arba'im shana ad bo'am el eretz noshavet et haman achlu ad bo'am el k'tzei eretz Kanaan. Right? The children of Israel ate the man for 40 years until they came to a land inhabited. They did eat the man until they came to the borders of the land of Canaan. And that's what we're told in Parshat Ekev as well. It will end. God tells them, if you look at source 15, I'm just going to, for the sake of time, I'm just going to read this in English. Hashem brought you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and depths springing forth in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey, a land wherein you shall eat bread without scarceness, you shall not lack anything in it, a land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you may dig brass. Israel would come to the land of Canaan and have to fend for herself. She would have to learn how to work this land of plenty and how to exercise their faith in new kinds of ways. They would have to learn, ironically, after having mastered trust, they would have to learn how to become independent. And now they'd be beset by a new challenge. And that is in Pasuk Yudalad, source 16. V'ram l'bavecha v'shachachta et Hashem Elokecha hamutziach me'eretz Mitzrayim mi'beit avadim. Their hearts would be lifted up and they would come to forget the God that took them out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And I think this challenge is posed to all of us. How can one be independent and self-sufficient and still trust in a higher power? I teach Jewish philosophy to high school age students, and my colleagues and I struggle all the time. How do we teach effective faith to young people today? How do you teach them to have a relationship with God? Is that something that can even be taught? Can you teach someone to trust in a higher power? How do you have a relationship with a God who has concealed himself? How does one build a religious character in a world that demands so much of our time and our energy and our effort and our reliance on our own self-initiative? We don't have the challenge which the Sforno said, that our material needs are taken care of. No, we have to be independent. We have to be self-sufficient. And it's a difficult task, and I think the halacha comes to assist us in that process. It gives us a place to ingrain the precepts into every fiber of our being. But how do we ensure that we don't become lazy, that we don't become complacent? How do we ensure that we're not remaining stagnant, that we're building, growing, that we're making meaning, that our relationship with God is constantly growing, when all the time we have to rely on ourselves in this world? That's the fate of a Hester Panim world, a world in which God has concealed himself. In some ways, we're more fully human, because God is not showing himself to us. And yet we have to believe in him. This is the paradox of the human situation. The balance between taking care of oneself and having trust in God continues. And I think that is our challenge, a challenge we face all the time. And so we need to do both. We need to prepare, we need to work, and we need to pray. Because man does not live on bread alone, but he can live on anything which the Lord decrees. Thank you very much.